This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. News of Steve Irwin's death last September shocked the world. Irwin, of course, became famous as the Crocodile Hunter, a television star and conservationist generally seen with a snake draped around his shoulders or leaping onto the back of a crocodile. He died while shooting a TV program off Australia's coast when a stingray barb pierced his chest. His work, however, continues. Terry Irwin, his wife, continues to operate the Australia Zoo they built up together, continues to develop television programs based on Steve's unique approach to animals and the audience, and she's now on tour in this country to promote her new book, Steve and Me. Terry Irwin is from Oregon, met Steve Irwin on a trip to Australia, helped to develop his TV character, helped develop one of her own, and much later introduced their daughter into the family television business. Indeed, some describe her as the brains of the outfit. Later on in the program, Michael C. Hall joins us to talk about his star turn as a serial killer with a conscience, Dexter. But first, if you want to talk with Terry Irwin, our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Terry Irwin is here with us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
G'day, Neil. It's great to be here.
And I guess newlyweds can sometimes be surprised on their honeymoons, but there can be few who've heard their husband say, "You jump on the head of that crocodile, I'll take the back."
True story. I had a very unique honeymoon. I think when Steve and I got married in Oregon, I had it all planned. We were going to tour around Oregon, see the United States, visit some of the spectacular wilderness and wildlife. And then we got a phone call from John Stainton, Steve's friend and the director-producer of our shows, who said, "Steve, you know, there's a problem crocodile in North Queensland, and the bad guys are trying to shoot it. Can you beat the poachers, and can we film you trying to catch this croc?" And Steve said, "Mate, I'm supposed to be on me honeymoon." So Steve asked me, and I said, "Of course, let's go for it." So off we went to North Queensland with a film crew instead of the honeymoon crew. And so we were off in the mangrove mud with the mosquitoes in the tropics and trying to catch this croc. Unfortunately, the poachers beat us to the big male croc, but we did catch a female in the area who was also in danger. And that's when I heard those fateful words. Here's this 9-plus-foot crocodile in a net. And Steve said, "Right, I'm going to get the net off. You jump her head." And I thought, what? It was incredible. But when you're with Steve, you just feel compelled to do what he says. I jumped on that croc's head, wrapped my arms around her strong jaws, held on for grim death, and like a horse, you can feel them building up. They then explode with action and settle down again to start their energy process all over. And so I'd hang on through this incredible fight, and then she'd relax again, and Steve would remove more net. I sweat all my mosquito spray off, never noticed any mosquitoes. And eventually we got her into the boat, relocated into the bush. We had a documentary and the beginning of The Crocodile Hunter.
And it's a great story. And it must have been a great honeymoon.
It was fantastic. And I have to tell you, Steve, being the ultimate bushman, was able to elude the crew quite regularly and efficiently. We did have time together.
Interestingly, you recount a conversation a little bit later on, after the crocodile hunter had become larger than life, shall we say, where Steve tells you it's a good thing that we met before there was a crocodile hunter.
Yeah, you know, we both said that that's just wonderful, because when someone gets more of a persona, a personality is more well known, there's a tendency to question, do you love me or do you love what you've seen on TV or on the movies? And we would marvel at how anyone in Hollywood managed to pull that off. You know, there's this real life action hero sense about Hollywood people. And with Steve, I always felt that way about him, but he was the real deal. So when I met him, he was just Steve Irwin, became the crocodile hunter, and the man I fell in love with never changed till the day he died.
Was he the same off camera as he was on?
You know, Neil, he wouldn't get that excited about dinner.
Sure.
He wouldn't go like, you know, "Steak and veggies, crikey." But he would about everything else. The kids would be catching beetles on the front porch, and he'd go out and just marvel at whatever they were enjoying in nature. And I admired that so much. There's a tendency to get so caught up in what you're doing. You know, Robert will walk up to me and say, "Look, I caught a gecko." And I'll go, "That's lovely, dear. That's great. I got to get back to this." Mm-hmm. But Steve would stop what he was doing and be genuinely passionately excited about whatever they were achieving. And I think that's what was so nice about Steve and so genuine, is he was the real deal and loved what he was doing.
Since, well, even before his death, you have also become a celebrity. Is that easy to deal with?
You know, Neil, I've had the easiest role ever. I went from being Steve's wife to Bindi's mother, and I'm very comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. It seemed like my role was more support crew, and I enjoyed filming with Steve. I enjoyed running Australia Zoo and all the research and conservation projects we were involved in, but I never felt that I was front and center, because Steve was just so skilled at what he did that I was as awestruck as anyone.
Mm-hmm. Your daughter, Bindi, is who you're talking about now, the star of her own television series.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I think I just inhaled a fly.
That's okay. I wanted to ask you, there's a moment where you come to, Bethesda, Maryland, not too far from here,
yes,
to sell the Discovery Channel on this new kind of documentary, the kind that you and Steve and produced in Australia. And you showed them the film, and there was like dead quiet in the room.
Yes, there was. Well, now our relationship has totally changed.
You know,
Bindi's got her own show, and it's great. But at that point, they carefully explained to me what a wildlife documentary was. It's like 80% wildlife, 20% presenter. And it was kind of that voice of God style, you know, let's examine the life cycle of the butterfly, mm-hmm, and oversee what's going on with nature. For Steve, it's getting in and around the animals to show you how special and lovely and wonderful they were, to dispel myths and to get you to see what they were all about. For example, you know, if Steve was next to an albatross, you would marvel at the size of a bird. If Steve was near an elephant seal, you could see just how fast it could move across the ground. And this was very interesting and fascinating, but they said it won't fit. And so they gave us an opportunity on a little network called Animal Planet, and it had about 250,000 subscribers at the time and now has some 90 million. So over the last 10 years, we grew with the network, and we're now seen in some 140 countries around the world, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's about 500 million viewers have experienced the crocodile hunter phenomenon. And it's been truly that. I think Steve's journey is something he never anticipated, but embraced and appreciated, being able to get his conservation message out to everyone globally.
There was also a business deal. We're going to get listeners have a chance to talk with you in just a moment. And by the way, if you'd like to join Terry Irwin, it's 800-989-8255. But there was a business deal you struck out very early in your relationship with Steve, where you would take salaries from Australia Zoo, where both of you worked, of course. You ran the place. But the money, any money that developed from Crocodile Hunter, from the TV enterprises, outside enterprises, t-shirts, whatever, that would go to conservation. Is that deal still in effect?
Yeah, that's something Steve and I agreed on when we first started filming, and it was a bit of a joke for quite a while, because for the first 4 years, we literally did good to break even. There was no money. But we agreed that the wage that we earned from the zoo is fine, and the traveling we did with the filming was the perk. So mm-hmm. we were happy. Now, today, of course, it's a bigger enterprise. We have a travel agency in addition to the zoo, retail opportunities around the world. We've got a whale watching company. It's ever expanding, and still, even though we've done a movie and so many documentaries, every cent goes back into conservation that we earn. And you know, that was something we never discussed again. It wasn't like, well, what do you think? Should we just lash out on this project instead mm-hmm. and do something for ourselves? For us, it wasn't a sacrifice to put the money back into wildlife. That's what we reveled in. That was our joy. And Steve never wavered on that. And it's the same today. Even with the book, what I make out of the book, I'm putting specifically into acquiring more habitats. I'm very proud of that.
Mm. Terry Irwin is our guest. Steve and Me is the book. 800-989-8255 is the number. Email us, talk@npr.org. Tony's calling. Tony with us from Oxford in Kansas.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I just wanted to say that because of Steve and Terry, my 23-year-old daughter now works at the Sedgwick County Zoo in Wichita, Kansas. she had emailed both of them several years ago when she was younger and just out of high school, and they had answered her email. And she was so impressed and so thrilled and brought it to show to me that she decided to go ahead and follow her dream, and she works at the zoo.
Wow, that's fantastic, Tony. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, and I know I'm thanking you on her behalf. She's going to be thrilled when I tell her that I spoke with you. And she has a python that she bought 2 years ago, and the python's name is Bindi.
Oh, that's wonderful. I can't wait to tell Bindi. She'll be so honored. Is it a ball python?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is.
Excellent. I love those. They make great pets. And I'll tell you, I think what you've said means so much to me, because now, after losing Steve, I think it's more important than ever that we stand shoulder to shoulder to continue this conservation work. So I really appreciate her efforts to continue Steve's legacy. Thank you very much.
Well, she had told me just a few weeks ago that it doesn't matter to her how much money that she ever makes, but she's found her calling, and she loves to go to work every day, and she just is just thrilled.
That's great.
You think she's ever considered public radio? We kind of work that way, too.
Well, I'll ask her.
That's right. Neil is a volunteer, in case you're
wondering. Not quite. Not quite.
No. Good on you, Matt.
Tony, thanks very much for the call. We wish your daughter the best of luck.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
And one of the, it must be a constant of people coming up to you at book signings and various events, and certainly in Australia, to say how you and your husband and now your daughter have touched their lives.
Well, it's something that I never take for granted, and I always find it so amazing because, you know, I've had role models in my life, and Steve definitely was one of my biggest, so I understand that, but it's a wonderful feeling, and it's a tremendous effort on people's behalf to stand up for wildlife. Mm. It's easier in the world today to kind of ignore everything, but to make an effort to make a career out of it is tremendous. And if everyone just does something, even if you're just recycling or you're riding the bus to work, if we all do something, we've got hope for the future. And if we don't, we're going to be in big trouble. So I appreciate that to no end.
We're talking with Terry Irwin about life with the crocodile hunter, and we'll take more of your calls in just a moment. 800-989-8255. You can also send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We'll get to our conversation with Michael C. Hall, Showtime's Dexter, a little bit later in the hour. Right now we're talking with Terry Irwin about her new book, Steve and Me. In it she tells the story of her life with crocodile hunter Steve Irwin, their family, the work they did together. You can find an excerpt from the book at npr.org/talk and read about the day Terry met a handsome young zookeeper at an Australia reptile park. If you'd like to talk with Terry Irwin, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Tanya with us from Chandler, Arizona.
Yes, hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Terry, I just wanted to really quickly tell you how much, obviously, like all millions of people, you and your entire family has meant to our family.
Thanks, Tanya.
And basically, as a mother, I'm very curious, you know, how difficult it must be for you in your support role. It's one thing to support a husband, but a child is obviously something that there's a parental aspect involved in. And just curious what your aspirations are for Bindi and what you would like to see.
Sure. Well, I think like any parent is, I love my children so desperately that first and foremost, I want to make sure they're healthy and happy. I want my kids to have a good spiritual foundation and be empowered in life in whatever they choose to do. Bindi's very blessed in that she's traveled with us from the moment she was born. Her birth was filmed. She's come with us on the road since she was 6 days old. It's been a beautiful, blessed life that we could take our children with us. Robert's got such a wonderful environment to grow up in, too. He's 3 years old now. I was listening to the didgeridoo music. And at Australia Zoo, we have the local Gubbi Gubbi tribe come in regularly to dance and tell people about the indigenous ways of Australia. And it's so funny. Robert gets, I don't know how to put this delicately. He's so white, and he goes in with the Gubbi Gubbi and gets all painted up so beautifully, and he dances like the Gubbi Gubbi, and it's the cutest thing to watch. And when I watch my children learning so much about different cultures, about wildlife, and having such beautiful, wonderful adventures, I think, you know, That's what we all need to do for our kids. We all need to give them a chance and do what we can to back them up. And don't worry what people say. If you've got kids who are enthusiastic about sports, encourage them. Don't let people say, "Are you pushing them?" Let them go for it. Let them have some fun and achieve some things in their life. When you're a little tiny person, like Robert's age, really you start with your name, who you are, who your parents are. You don't have much, and you can build off that to become a real strong, successful person. And I hope to do that with Bindi and Robert. I kind of think the die's cast. I think Bindi and Robert are probably going to be wildlife warriors just like their daddy, but whatever they want to do, I'll support them.
Well, I certainly think they are very lucky children to have had such great parents and great experiences, and you truly are all an inspiration to all of us.
Thank you. That's really nice of you. All the best.
Thanks for the call, Tanya. Your parenting skills have been questioned in the past. There was the baby Bob incident where your husband at one point brought your small baby boy into the crocodile area with him. Mm-hmm. I think everybody's seen the clip of film since then. It's interesting, in your book, you write about this as, look, this is something we did with our daughter for 5.5 years before that, and nobody ever seemed to complain about that, and we'd be untrue to ourselves if we did it any other way.
Yeah, it's interesting how something can be taken so out of context, but because we live at a zoo, we both agree that from the beginning we needed to teach our children about wildlife first and foremost. For a lot of children, it's busy roads and stranger danger.
Sure.
And things like that. With our kids, we've got crocodiles and venomous snakes and tigers and elephants in our backyard, so it's learning about wildlife. Steve took Bindi in with the crocs when she was about a month old and had been doing croc shows with her ever since. And because Bindi plays with kangaroos and wallabies and koalas, it's not very eye-catching, but the crocodile work was. And she was on national television now and then, and people mm-hmm. spoke about it. But for some reason, the day the Tibetan nuns came in the zoo to talk about raising funds for what they needed and to bless Robert, that day was somehow different, and I don't really know why. Steve took Robert in with the crocs kind of on a whim, much as he had done with Bindi, and it was a real Lion King moment. Here he is with his son and was so proud, and we were so interactive with wildlife and our kids that we never thought this was going to broadside anyone. Fortunately, the support we got from people was just marvelous. I remember one woman who wrote and said, "I've got a new baby, and if Steve wants to take him in with the crocs, he can do it anytime he wants." Hmm. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to say. Steve was so incredibly skilled with crocodiles. He loved his son so desperately, and there was nothing more natural. You have to understand that's how he grew up.
Sure.
So today,
that zoo was owned by his parents.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Bob and Lynn raised Steve much the same way. So now, even though we don't have Steve, the crocodile work must go on. Sunday night on Animal Planet is going to be a show called In His Footsteps, our first research trip without Steve. And you'll get to see me and the kids working with crocodiles, and you can judge for yourself, see what you think.
As long as we're on criticism, you mentioned that meeting at Discovery Channel all those years ago. Mm. They've changed their mind since, of course. But the traditional focus on nature documentaries was on the animals, on the wildlife, as opposed to being on the host of the program who was in, as Steve was, almost every shot. There have been critics, other people say, look, you can do television documentaries perfectly well showing animals in their native habitat without having somebody in there holding them up by the neck.
You can, but what you're doing is you are preaching to the converted. People who enjoy watching wildlife documentaries on that long lens at a distance are wildlife documentary lovers. Steve wanted to encourage people to love wildlife who wouldn't traditionally watch these shows, like people who watch sports or sitcoms or cartoons. Let's get from kids to grandmas involved in wildlife. And for Steve, it wasn't so much grabbing things by the throat as picking them up and truly, passionately loving them.
Mm-hmm.
And something occurred to me after losing Steve, and I would think about so many spiritual things and read the Bible a lot. And the passage, "Perfect love casts out fear," intrigued me. It's always intrigued me. What exactly does that mean? And I thought about Steve. You know, he loved those animals so perfectly, he wasn't afraid of them. And I got it for a moment. And I thought, what a great lesson he gave us in life, to love someone or something so genuinely that there isn't any room for being afraid. It means you're going to take opportunities, you're going to have a better life, you're going to love things more. And let's not forget, Neil, the bizarre thing was, animals came to him. I watched an orangutan in Indonesia climb down out of a tree with her little baby orangutan, while the ranger was saying, "Oh, Steve, get out of the tree. This orangutan's going to pull your arms off." The mother came all the way down, dragging this little baby along with her, sat on the limb next to Steve, put her arm around Steve, this is a wild orangutan, and started making kissy faces at him with her lips. Now, where did that come from? I don't know, but no one before or since has communicated and connected with wildlife like Steve. But he was determined to give us all that gift, that we can all take a moment to appreciate the animals around us.
Well, I don't know where it came from, but she probably heard from your lawyers the next morning.
Yes.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is, Molly. Molly with us from St. Louis.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Thanks, Molly.
I wanted to say, first of all, Terry, I can't tell you how much your show has meant to me over the years. When I heard about Steve's death, I cried, and I cried like we'd lost a relative. I'm so sorry that you lost him. But my question is, how difficult was it for you to make the decision to continue with the work after he died? I mean, I realize it must have been a very personal thing and very painful, but I want to know, what prompted you to do that, and did you ever have doubts about doing that?
You know, that's a valid question, Molly, and I'll tell you what, when you lose someone that you're that close to, initially you do just kind of want to curl up in a corner and have the world go away. And for about 3 weeks, it's kind of like being in shock, and you're running on, I don't know, automatic pilot. But Steve made me make a promise, and he said to me early on in the piece, "Promise me if anything happens to me, you'll keep Australia Zoo going." And I thought it was so interesting. It wasn't the filming. It wasn't anything else. It was just the zoo, where his home was, where his heart beat from. And I made that promise. When I was able to think more clearly, I realized that I still had such affection and love for Steve, and still kind of that, I don't know, cheeky competitiveness with him. I enjoyed that in our relationship. So I sat down with our management team. I got out everything off his desk, which planned the zoo for the next 10 years. And I said, let's do it in five. So in the first year, we did everything from a whale watching business to securing another 320,000 acres of conservation land. Bindi's finished Bindi the Jungle Girl. She's designed a clothing range. We opened a new retail store. I've started Crikey Magazine and the news agencies in Australia. I've continued our international crocodile rescue program, our research program. We're building a new wildlife hospital, which will open in March to take twice as many sick, injured, and orphan animals. All this because I feel so compelled not to let what Steve lived and died for disappear. And I can assure you, I don't wake up every day feeling great. I wake up every day and I am a determined woman, and that's not going to stop. I've got a great family. I've got people like you, Molly. And I have to tell you, Molly, come to Australia Zoo. You'll want to meet Molly. She's a very special saltwater crocodile.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for going on with your work. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call, Molly. Let me read you a passage from later in your book. "As I write this, I'm still waiting for Steve to walk through the door. His sarong still hangs on the bed. His toothbrush is in the bathroom. Reality is sinking in more and more. Bindi and I have a lot of heart-to-heart talks. These seem to help her, just like when she was younger and lost a special koala named Wilson." And your son, you write, also, at the time you were writing the book, sometimes getting his bath at night, would just sob, "I miss my daddy. I miss my daddy."
Yeah.
These are difficult things, very difficult things to overcome. Will there come a time when you put the toothbrush away?
I don't know. But what I've learned, and not on my own, but with great advice and help from others, including professional help from a psychologist, is that as long as it's not self-destructive, it's okay. And your grief path is your own. So if you lose someone close to you and you have to immediately put everything away, that's not any crazier than if you want to leave everything out. It's okay. And for me, part of writing this book that I found so important was sharing my journey so other people can say, all right, I'm not nuts here. It's all right. And, you know, here's somebody who can get up the next morning and take the next step. I'll give it a go. And to realize that if your children are having a hard time, you know, acknowledge your grief, honor it, and the next day maybe you'll get a little bit of joy. So while the book was hard to read and it's hard to think about it and remember, I think it's important for everyone to know that it is your journey and it's okay for you to seek help and take it yourself.
Mm-hmm. I think you meant the book was hard to write.
Yes. Yes, it was a difficult project. I think I started writing in February and I just took it with me everywhere. I traveled with it. I wrote this book everywhere from by the campfire in Cape York Peninsula to downtown New York doing promotional work. It came with me everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Terry Irwin's book is called Steve and Me. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Judy's with us. Judy calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Terry.
Good day, Judy.
My son has been going to the zoo, for the last several years. And this last December through January, I went with him to Australia and to New Zealand. And, of course, the highlight had to be we had to go to the zoo because I'm an animal lover. And the day we went, there the entry was a camel who I got to pet and watch cud like I'd never seen come out of its mouth, pet a koala. I also got to touch a blue-tongued lizard. It was just amazing.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, and to see the memorial that people had placed for him with shirts, all the different size shirts where they'd written all their love and their sentiments and joy for having, you know, seen him or been to the zoo was amazing.
It's just
to
wonderful.
Me. And also be able to touch the kangaroos the way you had spots where it said, you know, we need a timeout or whatever it said, where the kangaroos could go without any human contact. And earlier when you were talking about how you didn't take any money or whatever for anything but the salary that you took, why would you? I mean, what a perfect place for kids to live. I mean, that's where less really can be more, in a sense. You know, you're out in nature. What more do you need?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
No, I agree with you completely. And and I think, too, that the fact of the matter is at Australia Zoo, another interesting irony with that is we always place the animals' needs first, our
right.
team second, and our visitors third. So like your experience, when you come in, you're not going to see unhappy animals and frustrated staff. And then you end up coming first. And that's what people forget. By the way, I have to tell you, with the camel, now you know where we get the foam for the cappuccino. So I hope you didn't get a coffee or you're in trouble.
You know, the
you charge extra for that, I'm sure, yes.
Yeah, talking about, you kind of smell the roses. It wasn't exactly a rose the other day, but I was driving past the Audubon Society here in Portland, and I saw this bird with its wings, you know, just out. I don't know what you call it when they're out, the wings are expanded.
Yep.
And I turned around and came back and slowly drove in, and I stopped and I got out of the car and I said, can I come and see this bird? I thought it was an eagle at first, but it wasn't. It was a turkey buzzard, but they gave it another name. And it was a turkey buzzard that somebody had decided to raise from its infancy back at the beginning of the year. And it ended up at a doorstep of a family down in McMinnville, Oregon. I don't know if you know where McMinnville is.
I sure do.
Bet she does. Yeah. She grew up in Eugene.
Yep.
Yeah. And it wouldn't leave because obviously it was tame enough. And so now it's up at the Audubon Society getting kind of training or whatever so that it can be shown
get some street cred, perhaps, so it can deal with those other turkey vultures out there.
Yeah, no, and from time to time, animals do come in that for whatever reason can't be released back to the wild. And that blue-tongued lizard you met may have been one of those. And it's so nice if we can provide a good home for something that can't live in the wild. And it's so terrific. At Australia Zoo, we've got our wildlife hospital where some 5,000 animals a year get a second chance. And that's terrific what the Audubon Society's doing.
We just have a few seconds left. Let's see if we can get Kim on the line. Kim is with us from Logan in Oregon. Utah, isn't it?
Logan, Ohio.
Okay, one of those.
That's great.
Hi.
G'day, mate.
I've watched Steve since I was a little girl, and when that happened to him, I was completely devastated. But thanks to him, I'm going to be, like, a wildlife conservationist and... There's, like, no doubt in my mind that I'm going to do that because I don't want him to die in vain.
Good on you, and I think he'll carry on with your work.
I'll make sure I do.
Thank you.
Where are you now?
I'm on the way to my house.
Oh, no, I meant in school.
I'm in 11th grade.
In 11th grade, junior in high school.
Oh, that's excellent. I'll tell you what, Kim. At Australia Zoo, we do have a volunteer program for anyone who's 16 years old or older. So if you're planning a trip to Australia, come give us a hand.
I definitely will.
Kim, thanks for the call. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Terry Irwin, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil. It's been great.
Terry Irwin's book is Steve and Me. Coming up, Michael C. Hall, TV's most popular serial killer, joins us. If you have questions for the man behind Showtime's Dexter, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.